It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, March 10th, 2024. I'm Jared Halpern. President Biden uses his State of the Union address to try to turn the tide on how you feel about the economy.
Now our economy is literally the envy of the world. 15 million new jobs in just 3 years, a record.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. This week it essentially became a two-man race with Nikki Haley exiting the Republican contest. But did her supporters like what President Biden had to say at the State of the Union, or are they still looking for someone else to vote for?
Some of them are just dead set against Trump. They're not going to vote for him no matter what. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they would vote for Biden either. They might write someone in. They might vote third party. They might leave the top of the ticket blank.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. One of the biggest headwinds President Biden faces in his re-election bid is the economy. A Fox News poll published a few days before Thursday night's State of the Union address found just 1 in 4 Americans feel optimistic about where the economy stands. The majority of independents, 81%, rate the economy as only fair or poor. And more than half of all voters say they have less money in their pockets today than a year ago. So it's not surprising the president is trying to reverse those sentiments.
My inherited economy is on the brink. Now our economy is literally the envy of the world. 15 million new jobs in just 3 years, a record, a record. Unemployment at 50-year lows. A record 16 million Americans are starting small businesses, and each one is a literal act of hope.
President Biden also laid out new proposals designed to bring down costs, he says, to make life more affordable for more Americans. One that will be unveiled in the White House budget this month would create a new tax credit for new home buyers, as much as $5,000 a year for 2 years.
I know the cost of housing is so important to you. If inflation keeps coming down, mortgage rates will come down as well, and the Fed acknowledges that. But I'm not waiting. I want to provide an annual tax credit that will give Americans $400 a month for the next 2 years as mortgage rates come down, to put toward their mortgages when they buy their first home or trade up for a little more space.
Jared Bernstein is chair of President Biden's Council of Economic Advisors, helping craft policies like tax credits. He joined me to talk about that proposal, the president's message to boost confidence in the economy, and the Friday jobs report. Employers added 275,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate stayed below 4%.
Well, it's certainly clear that we have a very strong and a very healthy job market that just continues to defy expectations. And look, from our perspective, that's just unequivocally good news. In terms of a sustainability question, there you really need to look at inflation and wage growth. And you see something really important there, Jared. You see inflation coming down, down 6 percentage points off of its peak. So that's been great to see. And you see nominal wage growth coming in at a more sustainable pace. But the important point is that wages are outpacing inflation. So inflation is slowing faster than the wage growth is slowing. It's decelerating more quickly. And that means real wage gains. So that's sort of a nerdy economist way of explaining that we're seeing real wage gains for something like 10 months in a row now. We don't have inflation for February yet, so we don't know. But remember, wages grew 4.3%. February to February over the past year. And that's very likely, of course, to be ahead of inflation.
As you look at that, I know one of the concerns is the Fed was trying to handle inflation and sort of slow down business spending a little bit with the increased interest rates. Do you run a risk now of seeing that inflation tick back up as folks are kind of spending more money, as folks are getting back into the labor market?
Well, first of all, folks getting back into the labor market, and we're seeing some nice movement in that direction for women, prime age women in this report. I think this is kind of under the hood, so it's been underreported. We saw a real nice tick up in their labor force participation rate, and it's close to its historical high going back, you know, I think 70 years. So that's helpful on inflation because that's a supply side advantage. It increases the economy's capacity and puts downward pressure on inflation. In terms of interest rates and the Fed, obviously we don't get into monetary policy, but the trajectory of inflation continues to come down. And yes, you're gonna have months that are gonna blip one way or the other, but even the CPI, which came in hotter than expected in January, it was 3.4% in December and 3.1% in January. So it can't, you know, it grew more slowly. I think the expectation was to come down even more, but the trend is our friend. It's moving in the right direction, and we have every reason to expect that to be the case. You mentioned consumer spending. Let me say a word about that because it's been so important to our economic recovery. One of the things that's happening, it's again, it's sort of nuanced under the hood. One of the things that's happening in our macro economy, our overall economy, is that a lot of people have burned through what was their excess savings. So during the pandemic, people had a lot of savings because they weren't spending as much money on services during the pandemic, and also because of the fiscal support. At least for the bottom half, three quarters, I think they've burned through most of that. And you might think, uh-oh, that's going to go the other way from your question. That's going to hurt consumer spending. But as excess savings has burned off, real wages and incomes have come up. And I think there's a kind of baton handing there on the consumer side, and it's looked good to me.
But to that point, credit card debt is at an all-time high. Is that a healthy thing for the economy? Certainly, it seems like a dangerous position for a lot of families to be in.
Totally fair question, Jared. And I think the thing to look at there, so it's all the idea that credit card debt, because there's just more and more people over time and they have credit cards and probably have more credit cards. Credit card debt is one of those things like sort of like GDP. You know, it's the highest ever every quarter because it just generally goes up. The question, you have to scale it by something. So if you look at credit card debt with respect to income and you consider the fact that income has been going up and you ask, how easy is it for people to service that debt? That's the key economic question. We think it looks very serviceable and something that, you know, we're going to put on our watch list, but not worrisome at this point.
Is that watch list like what is the default rate end up being? Is that what the concern would be?
The watch list is all the variables that you might think of as banana peels, right? So we have a good economy. We have a great macro economy. We have a great GDP growth. We have a great labor market. Unemployment, as of this morning, below 4% for 25 months in a row, real wage gains. But there's always banana peels out there, and that's my watch list. And credit card debt, really debt of all types, is something that lives on the watch list because you have to monitor its sustainability. The way we look at it, though, is debt service. Given rising incomes, we look at credit card debt relative to incomes, and that looks moderate to us.
Is the White House, is President Biden specifically frustrated at interest rates and kind of how slowly that they seem to be kind of leveling off? I know you don't want to get involved in and sort of dictate to the Fed, but he did talk about interest rates in the State of the Union last night.
So, I mean, I think the first thing that comes to mind in hearing your question is coming off last night's performance in State of the Union, this president is anything but frustrated. I just think you watch that speech and what you see is optimism, is a just absolutely fiery spirit, a president who is clearly painting a key contrast between competing visions for the country, if not the soul of the nation. And so I don't think frustration and Biden belong in the same sentence right now. In terms of interest rates, I think the important thing there gets to the housing discussion. And he talked about housing in some depth last night. And I think that was really important. The cost of housing is so important. And he knows that affordability remains a challenge. We have a housing shortage, affordable housing shortage that was 10 years in the making. And one of the things the president talked about last night was a first-time, first-generation home buyer tax credit that actually offsets about a point and a half of the mortgage rate. In terms of what it means to people who are trying to buy homes. So we're very sensitive to that. We're working hard to try to help.
That's what I wanted to sort of hone in on. This $5,000 tax credit for mortgages. I want to go a little bit deeper in this because it seemed like a brand new kind of policy that the president laid out in the State of the Union. You're going to need congressional buy-in for this. Explain to me kind of the logistics and the mechanics. So this would be short term, right? The president said over a 2-year period.
Well, it's $10,000, not $5,000, because it's $5,000 for 2 years. So that's what he meant by the 2 years. Yeah. Okay. So it's a $10,000 tax credit for first time home buyers. It is part of an agenda to build or renovate more than 2 million homes. And there's lots of other policy in there as well. There have been first-time homebuyer credits before. It's not that unusual a policy. You're absolutely right that we need a Congress. I think what's salient about it right now is that the pressures on homebuyers, and part of that is the high mortgage rate, but part of it is just a really undersupplied market where supply and demand are just misaligned. Home prices have really remained high. So that's an intervention that, as I mentioned, will help significantly offset that cost for lower income people. But I think the key there is that we can't just work on that sort of demand side of the equation. We have to work on the supply side. And there, again, we have detailed plans to renovate millions of homes, build millions of homes. And by the way, we're also very happy to see that nearly 1.7 million homes are currently under construction. And that's a record in terms of home under construction. And by the way, those are mostly multifamily dwellings, which are very important on the rental side.
A couple of follow-ups on that. One is, as far as this tax credit that the president proposed, is it sort of means tested? What are the caps for it? Who would qualify? Who wouldn't? How are we sort of defining first-time home buyer in this context?
So these details will come out with the budget next week, so I don't want to get ahead of them. But yes, it will be targeted at middle and lower income people, and it goes further because it's a larger share of their income, so it helps them more.
Are there enough existing homes that lower income and middle income Americans can afford right now? Home prices are so high, even for pretty modest dwellings.
The answer to your question is a hard no. There are not adequate existing homes. And in fact, our team estimates that the gap between what we have and what we need in terms of housing in general and affordable housing in particular is somewhere in the 3 to 4 million range. This has been building for 10 years. This met us when we got here and we started right away to try to help. And in fact, we've been able to reduce mortgage insurance premiums by $800 a year for thousands of first-time home buyers, expanded rental assistance to 100,000 households. And as I mentioned, 1.7 million homes under construction right now, mostly multifamily. That's positive. By the way, one thing that slipped by, I think people didn't quite catch it in the speech last night, was actions that we plan to take in this space to significantly reduce the cost of title insurance, especially for refinancers. Title insurance is one of the ways that people get ripped off when they're refinancing their home. And it can be thousands of dollars. And you need title insurance. So that'll be there. But it shouldn't cost that much. And Fannie and Freddie already have a pilot program that's working well in that space. And we want to expand that.
When we look at sort of this housing initiative and the mortgage initiative, I know you still kind of have to work through it at the budget process, but is there an assessment, a prediction on kind of what that cost, what this $10,000 credit would cost, and whether or not it would be offset somewhere else through tax revenue?
Yeah. So, again, these are detailed budget questions and
my apologies.
I can talk about the budget when it comes out, but I can give you some rough ideas. First of all, anytime you talk about getting bipartisan cooperation, I'm sure a lot of people think, well, that's not going to happen. But it's an interesting thing in housing because it's not really a red-blue thing, right? I mean, there are housing shortages in red places, in blue places, all across the country. And so it turns out that for some of the measures, expanding the low-income housing tax credit, that's a good example. Now, expanding LIHTC, that's the acronym for the low-income housing tax credit, expanding LIHTC is both in the bill that the House recently passed. So, you know, this tax bill that the House recently passed is for tax extenders for businesses, but also includes the child tax credit. It's been underreported that there's an expansion of LIHTC in there that should help to build 200,000 affordable units. That passed the House. There are actually hundreds of members on both sides of the aisle who support these issues. Now, in our budget, to get to your other question, we have a set of measures to expand affordable housing that come to around $250 billion over 10 years in expenditures, fully paid for. So I'm happy to come back and go through the details on that. You seem to like to get into the budget weeds, and that's cool with me.
I know, because obviously the deficit and things, or the president talks a lot about trying to reduce the deficit and you know, have different mechanisms to pay for these types of programs. Certainly the president talked a little bit about that in the context of billionaires and corporate tax rates. Let me finish with this, and this is kind of more at a much sort of 10,000 feet level. President Biden, at least polling suggests, is still underwater as it relates to handling of the economy. What can we expect to hear from him, hear from the team over the next sort of 8 months to turn that sentiment around?
I think that sentiment is already starting to turn around. Over the past 3 months, the consumer sentiment measure that's most closely watched is up, surging really, up 25% in 3 months. I think that we haven't seen an increase like that for 30 years, I believe. And our theory of the case, coming from the president himself, has long been, if we can maintain a tight job market, which we saw this morning, by the way, for February, so let's not forget that job story. I don't want to let it get lost in all the news we have today. This is a great jobs report. If we can maintain that job market while continuing to ease inflationary pressures, we should see real wages and real incomes grow. Exactly where our conversation started. Under that kind of a set of conditions, people's paychecks, by definition, the buying power is increased. We're also doing everything we can to lower costs. We just talked about title insurance, but there's junk fees. You heard the president talk last night about healthcare, prescription drugs, measures, by the way, which our opponents are trying to repeal, which would lead to higher costs in those areas. If we can keep lowering costs while keeping real wages and incomes going up, we've always said sentiment will start to come up. And in fact, that's precisely what we've seen, and not just a blip, but for about 3 months running. So we think we're on the right track. Our work isn't done, Jared. We have to build on the progress we've made. But directionally, I think we're in a strong place.
Jared, appreciate the time as always. I like that you let me get into the weeds a little bit with you. It's always fun for me. And enjoy the weekend, and we'll be in touch soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jared. Bye-bye.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
This past week, several states voted in what is known as Super Tuesday, and every state but Vermont went for former President Trump on the Republican ticket. Nikki Haley announced the suspension of her campaign the next day.
In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. I wish anyone well who would be America's president. Our country is too precious to let our differences divide us.
Heading into Super Tuesday, former President Trump spoke from Mar-a-Lago after the Supreme Court said Colorado couldn't kick him off the ballot.
Historically, a thing like what I've been going through would have hurt a political party or a political candidate terrifically. You wouldn't even run. You wouldn't be able to run. You'd get out. This has happened over many years, many times. In this case, the polls show that I'm much more popular than I was before weaponization.
Arguing that President Biden should have all the legal cases against him dropped. Biden did not sound open to such a possibility in his third State of the Union address, this one given in an election year. His speech was political, as he mentioned former President Trump several times, though not by name.
A former Republican president tells Putin, quote, do whatever the hell you want. My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. Many of you in this chamber and my predecessor are promising to pass a national ban on reproductive freedom. My God, what freedom else would you take away?
So did President Biden make the case to Nikki Haley supporters? His campaign said after she suspended her campaign that there was a place in his campaign for her voters.
Well, I think it depends on what profile of Nikki Haley supporter you're talking to, right?
Guy Benson is the host of The Guy Benson Show on Fox News Radio.
There are certainly some of them who are just Democrats who plan to vote for the Democratic ticket in the fall. They were always going to do that. But in the Republican primary, they felt like perhaps their vote was better used crossing over to the Republican side and trying to lodge some sort of protest against Donald Trump or block him in some way. Those voters, that group of them, obviously will just move right along to November and they'll be voting for the Biden ticket. Then you've got the more complicated group of Haley voters. And I think most of these voters are conservatives or Republicans or independents who are generally predisposed to vote for the GOP and have done so in the past, but they have trouble getting over the hump with Donald Trump and have done so maybe even all the way back to 2016. They just wrestle with him as a political figure, as a leader of the party. And so, you know, I think some of them, I know a number of them, some of them are just dead set against Trump. They're not going to vote for him no matter what. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they would vote for Biden either. They might write someone in. They might vote third party. They might leave the top of the ticket blank. They're just trying to figure that out. They might write her in, right? Then you've got other people who probably still dislike Joe Biden and his governing outcome so much that they're going to vote for the Republican nominee no matter who it is. They just didn't want it to be Trump. But if it's him, and particularly depending on who he picks as his vice presidential nominee and sort of how the general election campaign is fought, they are probably gravitating to be Trump supporters. So I think there's probably going to be this interesting mix between partisan Democrats just going back to their normal voting patterns and then the center-right voters just deciding, can I pull the lever for this man or not? I think it would be wise and would behoove Trump to try to pull as many of them in as possible, because most of those Haley voters are strongly, strongly disapproving of the job Joe Biden is doing as president.
So her dropping out when she did, is that it from her? You know, just to your point about where some of these voters could go, because she'd said, I don't want to do no labels. You know, I'm a conservative. A unity ticket is not interesting to me. But she said the voices of the millions of people who don't want a rematch between Biden and Trump should be heard. How, Guy, should they be heard? Should RFK Jr. hear them? Like, would she endorse him possibly if it's not going to be her as the independent?
No, I mean, I'd be very surprised. Who knows? Politics can be weird and things can move around, but I'd be very surprised if she endorsed anyone other than Donald Trump. She might not endorse anyone, or if she's going to endorse, I think it would be Trump. And I would argue that the voices that she's describing, the millions of them, have been heard. At least in these early states, there have been options for people. If they were really unhappy with the choices at hand from both major parties, they had a chance to come out and vote for Dean Phillips or Uncommitted or Marianne Williamson or something like that on the Democratic side, or any number of candidates on the Republican side, all the way back to Iowa. How many of them made the ballot? Quite a few. So there was a chance for people to do exactly what she's describing, and elections matter, results have consequences, and the vast majority of people overall, certainly on the Democratic side and a sizable majority on the Republican side, they've decided, you know what, the rematch that the polls suggest broadly is an unpopular rematch, that's the rematch, at least on their end, that they want to see, and that's how democracy works. That's the rematch we're going to get in all likelihood.
Do you see the results from Tuesday, Guy? Like, okay, every state went for Trump except Vermont. So Trump, wow, he's the party's guy. Or were there enough double-digit numbers in Nikki Haley's column that you say, well, he might be the party's guy, but he still is an issue.
Yeah,
he needs these voters.
It's a Rorschach test, right? It could be either one.
Yeah.
If you're a pro-Trump person, you say, look at this blowout. He basically swept her. She won D.C. with a tiny turnout in Vermont, a very blue state. Okay, whatever. Shrug it off. Trump's the dominant victor, right? That's the Trump line. Everyone get in line. We've got to unify. But if you're a Haley supporter or a Trump skeptical conservative or just someone looking at the electoral dynamics generally, you are pointing to those double-digit areas in most of the states where Nikki Haley was, you know, let's say in the teens or in the 20s or in the 30s or in the 40s, right? Those are voters that are going to matter a lot in a general election. Even if you want to say, okay, well, a big chunk of them are Democrats, I think that's true to maybe a small extent. I don't think most of them are Democrats. That's still a lot of recalcitrant, reticent, center-right voters that Republicans absolutely need to have in their column in November. And so I think that's part of the point that she's been making. And I think that's something that the Trump campaign needs to keep in mind. And I think that that's sort of how this will shake out. I don't know which way they're going to go. I don't know how much unity is going to come of this. But I think that that's probably the point she's trying to make.
Guy, turnout was low. I mean, the headlines I was reading from Maine, Arkansas, North Carolina, California, Massachusetts. Do we glean anything from that? Or does that just highlight, you know, what we've all been talking about, this, that the polling has indicated this lack of enthusiasm about this matchup? Or is there something maybe deeper going on here if the turnout was really as low as indicated?
Well, I think it's interesting that the turnout in the South Carolina primary was high on the Republican side. It was abysmally low on the Democratic side. But on the Republican side, it was actually higher than it was in 2016 in a very contested cycle with many people fighting it out, and still pretty early in the whole Trump phenomenon. You had a higher number of people turn out on the GOP side this time around. And I wonder if that was almost seen as like a last stand where Trump had swept the other early states. He had these commanding leads in most of the Super Tuesday states based on polling. It was Nikki Haley's home state. So there was enough interest ginned up to say, okay, if something is going to change, if there's going to be a shift in trajectory, let's see what happens in South Carolina. And there was this burst of more interest. And then Trump won by, you know, 20 points. And I think there was just at that point a general sense among Trump's fans, among Trump's haters, detractors, whatever, okay, this thing is basically over. And obviously, in certain spots, I mean, if you look back to Super Tuesday, especially in kind of well-to-do, affluent, suburban enclaves, Nikki Haley cleaned up. And Donald Trump and the Republicans generally have struggled in those areas in the last number of years. So that's something Republicans need to think about seriously looking ahead to November. But I think overall, to your point about turnout, I just think there's just a sense in the country, even within the bases, we know what's going to happen. Okay. It's going to be Biden as the incumbent. Now it's going to be Trump. So there's less of an incentive for people to get out, like, not to throw them under the bus, but my own parents on Super Tuesday, they live in one of the states. And I was on my way to the polling place in my state. And I said, oh, I'm going to go vote. They're like, oh, yeah, that's for us today, too. We're just not going to bother. And they're patriots who care about the country, and they'll vote in the general election. But they just felt like this ball game is over. And they had other things to do on sort of a nasty, chilly, rainy day. I think that's probably some of what played out in a lot of people's minds. So I wouldn't read too deeply into it. I would say that there are some enthusiasm problems on the right with Trump, especially in some key areas. And then there are big enthusiasm problems for Biden on the Democratic side as well.
Yeah. Let me get your thoughts before I let you go about the State of the Union. Everyone seems to agree this was fiery, political. But did he make the case for himself on two fronts, politically, but also in terms of his health and his age, his mental sharpness?
You know, I tend to think, and I know this is sort of a hot take from someone whose job it is to comment on politics, but I tend to think that these things don't matter at all. We all talk about them like they matter immensely, and we chatter about them and pay great attention and break them down for a day or two. And then by next week, if you go back and you're like, okay, what was a big thing that he said? I think even people who watched it might draw a blank, and most Americans didn't watch it. So, look, he made the case for himself. I think the goal was send him out there with a full head of steam, be as energetic as possible, pump him full of whatever he needs to be pumped full of to have that stamina, that excitement, and all the adrenaline and the full pageantry of it all. And, I mean, he was very shouty. He spoke very quickly. I think that he was trying to signal, like, you know, look, I can do this. And because the Democrats have been so worried about him and the enthusiasm issue that I mentioned a moment ago has been so prevalent, I think for him to come out guns blazing in this very partisan, I mean, I think very inappropriately partisan way, it was a campaign speech, not a presidential one, that motivates the base that has been sort of underwhelmed and nervous, at least elements of it. And they all rushed out onto social media, which is a terrible focus group, by the way, but they rushed onto social media to proclaim how great it was and how back he is and how all these concerns were put to bed. We're so excited. What a fabulous job. I think they're probably insisting this a little too hard, how thrilled they are. But I think they view it as like a kind of morale boost, a shot in the arm. We'll see how long that lasts. I think a lot of Republicans, those who watched, thought it was kind of a grotesque spectacle and reminded them why they can't stand Joe Biden. And as I said, leading up to the speech on TV, I said they shouldn't set the bar on the Republican side so low that if he doesn't fall over, right, and fall asleep at the podium, it's considered a success. Occasionally, he can step up in prime time and relatively deliver when it comes to, you know, sharpness and that kind of thing. And he was fine. I mean, it wasn't great. I mean, it tailed off toward the end and he was slurring stuff, but that's sort of Joe Biden. I think that you're seeing both sides spin it the way they want to. And my overall takeaway is I think it will make not a lot of difference at all, even in the relatively short term.
Okay. Yeah, I think these things tend to accumulate, right? Like over time, like if you have a one-off moment, fine. But if you keep seeing the person act a certain way or behave a certain
sure.
way,
sure. Oh yeah, no. If he has a big
cumulative effect,
yeah. If he has a big turnaround, he's out there a lot and giving interviews, and he's sharp and lucid and all of that. Then maybe the narrative starts to change. Yeah. But every day that passes, he gets a day older. We're going to have the special counsel testifying next week, talking about that famous report and, you know, the memory problems and the infirmity that was described in that report. And the White House won't release the transcripts, I think, tellingly of that. So if there's another sort of flub or moment or stumble or what have you in the coming weeks, or they sort of hide him away, then the very calcified views of his age that really span partisanship, this is a broad consensus that he's too old. Yeah. I think that will take hold again. But for now, it's like a little bit of a respite for the Democrats, and they are going to milk it.
The more I think about it, you know, because you give yourself some time to think and you soak it up and you reflect. I was really struck now, I've decided, by the idea that he started out the State of the Union by telling us that he needs to wake us up like Roosevelt did ahead of World War II. That not since President Lincoln and the Civil War have freedom and democracy been under assault here at home as they are today, and that if you think Putin will stop at Ukraine, he won't. The opening of the State of the Union felt dark, even scary.
Yep.
And to hear that we need waking up, just like Americans did before a world war, you know, upon further reflection, Guy, I feel like a little alarmed.
I get it, and I think it's hard maybe to stomach that argument coming from a man whose staff generally limits his working hours from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., right? But wake up, America. Okay, if there's a real urgency of the moment, is this the person to lead us? Look, I think that what we saw over the last week, which is Donald Trump and his allies saying that Joe Biden is the worst president in American history, absolutely incompetent, ruining every major policy that he touches, and also mentally and physically unfit for the job. And on the other hand, you have Joe Biden saying, this is one of the darkest hours for the country, and if we don't wake up, we're going to slide into, you know, fascism and authoritarianism, and we could lose the country completely because Donald Trump and January 6th and all those things, democracy at stake. Those big themes, which are extremely negative, those are going to be the dominant themes of these campaigns for the next 8 months. So if it kind of made you feel dyspeptic and out of sorts and a little bit anxious, buckle up, because you're going to get a very, very heavy dose of exactly that for the better part of the next year.
Dyspeptic. Awesome. Thank you so much, Guy Benson, for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That'll do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown, we speak with Wyoming Republican Representative Harriet Hageman, who sits on the House Judiciary Committee, about Special Counsel Robert Hur's scheduled testimony on Tuesday, as well as the impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. We also speak with celebrity fitness trainer Jillian Michaels about the controversy surrounding weight loss drugs. Until then, thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.